Recording live stream is on. Bootleg is going. Hooray.
Call recorder has spoiled me.
We got one person listening on the live stream. So
hello.
I'm going to say David Schaub. I don't know. It's probably one of like three people who are listening to the live stream. There's one person.
This time it's probably not my mom.
Probably not your mom.
Oh.
She's very busy.
Hello, probably not Erica's mom.
Yeah, it's fine. When we talk about books, you see, the live stream is less exciting. A lot of people haven't read the books.
Our listeners are uncultured fools.
We love them.
Oh, we do love them.
We love them with their
uncultured fools.
With their hay seed in their mouth and their denim coveralls.
That's right.
And no shirt. Mm-hmm. And their straw hat. Because we are listened to by farmers, by stereotypical farmers. That's right.
And as we all know, farmers don't read, according to Jason.
They don't like to read science fiction.
No, there you go. They only read seed catalogs
and Animal Farm.
Oh, no. Jason Snell.
A lot of communism, a lot of socialism among the farmers. Some farmers are more equal than others. Whoa, what did I do right there? You know, I grew up on, well, it wasn't really a farm. It was more of a ranch than a farm. We had animals.
I have farmers in my family. Any of them read a lot.
Yeah. I mean,
take that.
There's, I mean,
probably
yeah, absolutely, because there's not a lot to do. Oh, no, no, I've offended them in a different way. No, I literally grew up in a one stoplight town, and we had cows and horses and a pig at one point, and yeah, never had any sheep, though.
My first job was on a feedlot.
See, there you go.
I'm sure I have been near a farm.
Well, you have, because you go out to the Amish country and there's lots of horses and
farms
Amish farms out there.
Many highly religious farms.
Mm-hmm. My sister-in-law grows canola. Well, her family does.
Oh.
Well, that's nice.
It was big in Alberta.
I saw some baby goats at a farm once.
I love baby goats.
They're very cute.
I took my dog to the vet and there were baby goats at the vet.
What?
The vet has apparently a reputation for having weird, like, unusually, I don't want to say weird, you know, but like animals you don't expect to see that are the vet's. So the vet has goats that are just hanging around at the vet's office. And they were like sitting on the steps. There's like a little staircase behind the reception area. And I was talking to the lady and suddenly two goats appeared and sat on the steps. And I thought, okay, it's a vet. They're animals.
I have a family friend on her farm. She raised, I don't know if she still does, but she used to raise goats for slaughter. But they were adorable to visit while they were alive.
Yeah, well, you know.
And probably delicious to eat after they weren't.
It happens. It happens. We slaughtered some of our cows and the pig. The pig. We ate the pig.
Oh, no. Yeah. Jason, did you help with the slaughter?
No, that my mom actually kept me in the house when the guy would come. The butcher would come, and they would take a cow and lead it into this into a corral, and then there would be the sound of a gunshot, and then the butcher truck would leave.
Wow.
But I did help. This one listener is going to love this. I did help castrate a cow one time.
Goodness. Wow.
And I did it wrong. Because the rubber band is super thick and was very hard for me to spread, because you have to spread the rubber band out in this little gadget that has four pins on it, and you squeeze it and the four pins spread and with the rubber band, and then you put it over the testicles and then you let it go, and that's the a safe way of making a steer. And you just cut off the blood flow to the testicles, and then that bull is not a bull, it's a steer. And we thought that had worked. Somebody should have checked my work. Because then later we noticed that steer was not a steer. It was becoming a bull.
Uh-oh.
And that was on me. That was my failure. I failed to properly convert the calf into a steer. So,
oh, dear.
One of my stories.
Talk about your blunders. Farm blunders.
We had two foals when I was there that I got to see them being born. That was pretty cool.
Aww.
Pretty cool. Two of our horses had foals.
When we were in Ireland, we met many lambs. They're very cute.
Lambs are adorable. They really are.
Marisa decided that she was never going to eat lamb again.
Yeah, Liz doesn't eat any sheep product. whatsoever. Because she lives, apparently that's, she lives in the country, so her neighbors are basically sheep.
Yeah. You don't want to eat your neighbors.
Did you,
yeah,
hear, the,
no,
did you hear the sound, Lisbeth? The crying of the lambs.
Oh, I hope she doesn't listen to the
I hope not. Everybody recording?
Yes.
All right, let's just do a podcast. Why are we doing this?
Okay. Farm talk.
Farm talk. It's great. This is why the members pay us, except for those who are farmers who are now canceling their subscription immediately. Yeah.
They won't be able to figure out how to cancel.
Oh no, Scott. Now I'm gonna have to do it all by email. You're so so mean. I just told a story about how I failed to castrate a calf. Come on.
Farmers are very smart.
All right. Scott's a city boy. You're a city boy, right? You've never lived anywhere but a city.
I haven't. So farmers really have support my lifestyle because I have I have no useful skills. Yeah. I would die very quickly if society were to collapse. So I thank you. My hat's off to you for keeping me alive.
Okay. We have 6 books to talk about, so let's get to it. Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I am your host, Jason Snell. This episode is all about books. We are, it's one of our 2 annual episodes where we look at books that are on a short list for the science fiction and fantasy novels of the year. This is for the Nebula Awards, which are given out by the Science Fiction Writers Association of America. And we have all read, I believe, 6 novel nominees. I will check in now with my panelists to see, to make sure if they've read all 6 or not. Aline Sims is here. Aline, did you read all 6?
I read all 6. Do I get a nebula?
No, but you get a gold star.
Sweet, I'll take it.
Millions of those. Well, no, that's a galaxy. What makes a nebula? It's just gas. Anyway, okay, your gold star is next to a nebula.
Awesome.
But is not a nebula itself, does not comprise a nebula. Erica Ensign, did you read all 6 books?
I did all the homework.
Thank you. And Scott McNulty, did you read all the books?
I did indeed.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Now, none of us remember any of them.
Usually it's just me.
But it's been, you know... I'm almost through the Hugo nominees now, and I had to think back to the Nebula nominees. But 6 books that obviously some group of people thought were among the best novels published in the genres of science fiction and fantasy in the last year. And I always read books that I would not otherwise have heard of or picked up, and am usually given a delightful surprise by at least one of them. And that's one of the reasons why I love doing these episodes, is it gives me a reason to go through the short list and read the books. And something funny happened this year. I don't know if all of you will agree with this or not. I would love to hear, which is I have my favorites, but I liked all 6 of these books.
Disagree.
Disagree.
Oh, dear. Well, I will agree.
All right, Scott, you and I.
Elaine and I are going to go do our own podcast.
I was going to say we're splintering into 2 dueling podcasts.
Oh, no. Agree and disagree. Well, let's see if the disagreeers agree on what they disagree about. This is very confusing. I put all 6 books into random.org, and that's the order in which we will speak about them. And then at the end, I'm going to cruelly make all of us, including myself, rank them from most liked to least liked so that we can generate a little table. So that there's a consensus list of what we liked
like
and what
I
we didn't.
I use random.org for that too.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could just tie them all, but you shouldn't. You should be forced to put them in an order. We are going to start with a book called Witchmark by C.L. Polk. Witchmark by C.L. Polk. Witchmark, which Goodreads tells me is the first book in the Kingston cycle. It is a fantasy novel about a world that... So one of the books we read last year on one of the shortlists was a book called Amberlow, which was... we had a little bit of a conversation about, is it fantasy or science fiction or something if it's basically all things that could have happened on Earth, except they use different names for the countries. And I said it wasn't, and everybody said I was wrong, which is fine. Witchmark really reminded me of Amberlow in a lot of ways, because it is similarly set in fictional countries that are still very clearly like a time in our history. The Amberlow is sort of set in Weimar Germany before the rise of the or during the rise of the Nazis, and Witchmark is set in sort of Edwardian England, except it's except not quite. Different country names and all of that. We've got another book
also
that's kind of
like
this too.
Clear magic, though.
But but that's the difference, is there is magic in Witchmark. And so therefore, yes, it is a fantasy novel. How did people, C.L. Polk is not an author I had ever heard of. But I in fact, I just looked up that the pronoun for C.L. Polk is she. She wrote Witchmark. The story is about the main character basically is a very important person who's basically run away from his family and has sort of decided he doesn't want to do whatever is intended for him in his life. And instead, he becomes a doctor and he joins the army and he goes to a war. And we hear that he was taken prisoner during the war and then released. And he's working in a hospital. He's tried to flee his very rich, powerful, important family. What we come to discover in this book is that he is actually part of a pair with his sister, and these people they're magical, and they have this sort of like symbiotic magic relationship where he is supposed to be sort of attached to his sister, who will be in charge, and he will power her, and their father is very important in the government, and they keep the weather it's weather oriented. They're like they would be horribly like devastated by bad weather if it weren't for the magic people kind of like keeping the climate fine. And so he is drawn back into his family circles while also investigating the mysterious death of a patient of his who knew who he was. And so then he and a man he meets, who turns out to be I guess a fairy, basically.
Elf, yeah.
Yeah, fairy, elf, magic, angel guy.
Celestial.
Yes,
creature.
Yes. A magical being from another plane.
A fake creature.
They have to solve a crime. And of course, it's all connected in the end, because of course it is.
And the thing that I liked the best was that it was connected to this mysterious malady that has struck down many of this doctor's patients. So it's all
That's part of the mystery, right? Is that there's the one person who dies at the very beginning and says, you know, you need to solve what's going on. And then he's got these patients that he's treating who are veterans, they're war veterans, and they all have these mental problems that basically we read it as PTSD, and then it is it's not, right? Like, that is part of his investigation, is that he discovers that there's a more magical story behind it, and so it's an interesting merger of a kind of, I don't know, almost Sherlock Holmesian kind of like mystery, where, you know, I've got to go talk to this person and talk to that person, and we'll see if I can figure this out. And then this whole other aspect of it, which is the family dynamic and the magic and him trying to kind of resist being what his family wants him to be. And I should say, there are. This is a book with LGBT themes, because our main character is a man, and the angel, fairy, angelic being, whatever, is also male, and they resist for a long time their incredible attraction to one another until they just can't anymore. Because spoilers, but they can't. They just can't do it.
It cannot be resisted.
I couldn't resist a celestial creature like that. So
it's no lie detected.
He is apparently quite dreamy. So what did you all think of Witchmark?
I really liked it.
Okay, I didn't. Go, Erica. Go.
This year I found it difficult. I didn't find any books that I really loved this year. Yeah. But with one exception, I didn't find any books that I really didn't love. It was just all a bunch of things that were interesting and fascinating to read. And this is probably more toward the top of my list, because it was fun to read. I enjoyed the mystery of it. It took me a little while to get into it because it is kind of, it's got that Edwardian thing sort of going on, and that's not exactly my jam. But once I sort of got used to the rhythms of the language and, you know, how important propriety is in this society and all that kind of stuff, I was sort of able to settle into it. And I like a good mystery. And I really thought that this was. I like it when there's a mystery mixed up with something fantastical or science fictional. And I thought that this book did a good job of melding those two. I am also a sucker for a character, like a point of view character, who runs away from their destiny and tries to escape it. Mm-hmm. So this book also had that. And I really sort of liked how at the very beginning, you don't actually know that that's going on at all, and then right. It slowly sort of creeps in, and then it becomes like a really big thing, and you realize, oh wow, this is quite a thing that he's running away from. And the deeper you get into it, the less you know who to trust, because the main character doesn't really know who to trust, up to and including the celestial being that he is sort of falling for. And yeah, and then I'm also kind of a sucker for fairies come to earth type stories. So it had that aspect too. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that were sort of mixed up well, I thought. And none of it took over the story too much to make it feel unbalanced to me. So it was all of these things put together with like a healthy dollop of a romance novel feel, which mm-hmm. I also enjoy. So yeah, I really enjoyed Witchmark, and I will probably read the next book whenever it comes out.
Scott, what'd you think of this one?
I also enjoyed it. I liked the, I know it's crazy. The system of magic was interesting to me. I liked the scene, the idea that the fancy pants people have magic, and there's a primary and a secondary, and the secondary has lesser powers, like, you know, healing people, but it's not as important as
they call it a trick. Rather,
they demean it, right? It's like, oh, you've got this trick that you could perform. And I felt an almost parallel with sort of like saying it's women's work, kind of like a gender role thing, where it's sort of like there's the class A, and then everything else is sort of dismissed as, yeah, it's helpful, I guess, but it's not important. And that's
right. We're going to use you as a battery for the real important work. Nobody cares about your little trick. So go
healing people or whatever. Who cares?
Whatever. I can make it rain. And I like to see where the someone's house is burning down and a fancy car pulls up and a woman comes out and makes it rain and she leaves. I thought that was an effective way to kind of introduce. You don't really know what's going on at that moment. And then it slowly becomes clear what is happening. And so I enjoyed that. I liked the fact that this is, I don't know if this is really an alternate history, kind of, maybe.
I mean, no, because I don't like alternate history. I like this.
Yeah, well, these countries don't exist, right? So it's like Amberlow. It's sort of like it echoes our history, but isn't.
Yeah, so I like the fact that it is not based on World War II, because
it's very World War One, right? Yes, post World War One feeling,
depending on where, what war, but. Not World War II. I've had enough of World War II influenced stories. Hmm. Thank you very much. So, take that, World War II. It's my hot take.
Yeah. Yeah, Pearl Harbor can suck it. Anyway.
That's right. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I liked the romance. I liked the whole society angle. I liked the, you know, how the main character is trying to resist his place in life, and then he kind of tries to, you know, he's basically defeated by it, and he has to, for the good of the country, he thinks, help go back to where he was supposed to be, and then it all turns out horribly wrong. So I enjoyed it all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, Aline. Go ahead.
I just forgot the you mentioned the LGBTQ angle, and I thought it was interesting that this society, in this society, it's sort of perfectly acceptable for a man to fool around with another man when he's younger, but as he ages, it's expected then that he settles down with a woman and has children.
They
and
get
that
married,
sort of,
right?
Yeah,
so the social dynamics are different. Like there's still some discrimination happening there, but it's mm-hmm. much more of a aren't you too old for this sort of thing kind of thing. Which is an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, which I like.
Mm-hmm. Aline?
So I liked all of those. No, I liked most of those things. I really appreciated the LGBTQ themes. I appreciated that people did not bat an eye at like a same gender relationship. I appreciated all of that. I'm not big into romance novels, and I'm wondering if that's why this just didn't land for me, that it was it felt more about the romance notes than it did the other notes to me, and I just couldn't get into it. There's so much to love. As you guys are talking, I'm like nodding my head. Yes, totally agree, totally on board. But it just didn't come together for me. And I have struggled to identify why exactly, but I just thought it was boring. And I could not get into it.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, because I said I liked all of the books I read. I think I'm going to rank this one last. And I liked it. But I was thinking about how this book has a lot of the same themes as Deadline, which is one of my very favorite discoveries. Borderline. As Borderline, which is one of my favorite discoveries of the short list of the last few years. And that's a whole series. It is similar in that they're sort of like, there's like fairy people and then the real world people, and there's an interesting magic system, and there's actually an idea where magic is being used by powerful people in questionable ways, and there's a sort of subjugated class of people with magic powers, and there are a lot of parallels between Witchmark and the Borderline series. There are a lot of differences too. Borderline is a you know, present day our world kind of setting, and this is Edwardian England style alternate country kind of setting, but a lot of the same themes, I thought. And what struck me was, as I was reading it, is I devoured Borderline, and Witchmark was kind of a grind. And I think it is that it is just not as, I think I would put it down to the prose. I think it's just kind of more of a chore because the writing isn't as good as the writing of a book like Borderline. And because all the pieces are there, and I didn't dislike it, but it felt like just more of a grind. And that's the best way I can describe it, is it took more work for me to get through this than something like Borderline, which I ripped through, even though I appreciate a lot of the themes that have a lot of similarities. So I think maybe that's, Aline, I mean, that was my reaction, is that I feel similar maybe to you in that it's just kind of harder to read, like not as fun.
Yeah, it felt more like when you talked about Sherlock Holmes, like it felt more like an older style prose, I think, maybe.
For sure.
Kind of the same way that, you know, everybody years ago was so in love with Jonathan Strange and Mr. whatever his face is. Yeah, thank you. Like, I tried reading that and I was so incredibly bored. And I think maybe that's just part of it, is it had maybe an older feeling type of prose. And I just couldn't do it.
Yeah, I think that's a stylistic choice on the part of the author. And if the style doesn't click with you, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
I think I could have possibly completely fallen in love with this book. And this could have been like a book that I discovered that I truly loved this year. Yeah, if it wasn't for that. So I definitely see that as like an extra level of difficulty that you have to hurdle before you can get into the rest of the story. And even I definitely found it more difficult to read. I'm actually currently, I decided to take a break from awards reading, and I'm reading the first of Naomi Novik's dragon novels, Temeraire, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I am finding that same trouble. I really am enjoying the story, but boy, the language is tough to get past. So I feel like Witchmark was maybe a little bit easier than I'm finding this current novel that I'm reading, but yeah, it's like adding sort of an extra layer on there that makes it a little harder to engage with the story. So I can totally see that.
All right. Let's move on to our next one as randomly selected, which is, speaking of Naomi Novik, Spinning Silver. Which is similar to Uprooted, which I think was last year. This is a novel that is sort of trying to take a classic kind of fairy tale concept and turn it into like remix it and turn it into something that is almost unrecognizable from the classic fairy tale concept. But to take it seriously and take the concept seriously. And so in Spinning Silver, it is loosely based on Rumpelstiltskin. There is somebody who can turn essentially a straw into gold, but it's actually it's a girl who becomes a kind of a money lender, and she ends up being very good at it, and she gets the money back and she reinvests it and she makes a lot of money. And this is the, you know, it is more of a metaphorical silver into gold, but she ends up being found by these magical people that they live kind of in fear of, who are, again, we've got a dichotomy between kind of a fairy world, a magic world, and the regular world. And these are the kind of like frozen winter people who keep it cold in the winter. And they want her to change silver into gold for them. And we end up with other characters, because we get a girl who ends up kind of like filling in for the money changer's daughter. And then there's a different girl who is betrothed to the king. So you've got sort of three women who are main characters. And we discover that there's this kind of ice king in the fairy realm. There is the actual king in this realm, but he's possessed by a fire demon. So we got a like fire and ice dichotomy going on. Which is Chernabog from Eastern European mythology, I think. So there's a lot going on here where she takes Rumpelstiltskin and spins it out into something much bigger and broader than what was there before. And this is a 480 page book. This is definitely a long novel. Who would like to let me know what they think first? Erica?
I liked it.
Aline, go ahead.
I thought it was good. I didn't like it quite as much as I liked Uprooted, but I enjoyed it. I liked how she stitched everything together. At first, when she had these three different stories, I was like, I'm not sure how they're going to come together, but I liked it a lot. I liked the Winter King. I liked the magic system. I really did enjoy reading it. It did get a little long there at the end. I don't remember exactly what I thought could be cut out, but I was like, I feel like this could have been tightened up a little bit, maybe a little bit less in whatever area that was I was thinking at the time. But I liked it. I thought it was good. I thought it was stitched together really well. And I really, really love stories of, you know, women being resilient. And this is definitely full of women being resilient, and I like it a lot.
For sure.
I was mistakenly under the impression that this was a sequel to Uprooted.
Me too.
So I went back and reread Uprooted before I read this, and I really liked Uprooted the first time, and I really liked it the second time, and then I read Spinning Silver, and it wasn't in the same, I mean, maybe it's in the same universe somewhere else, but it didn't feel like the same universe, and it was very different, and much, much longer, or at least it felt longer, and so I did like Spinning Silver, but I felt like the prose was almost more of an obstacle in this than it was in Witchmark. It didn't have that sort of old-fashioned-y style in the same way, but it's sort of written very almost cold like you know, brief short sentences that sort of, you know, are right to the point and in a lot of places, and I found myself having to reread bits and pieces because I just couldn't quite parse exactly what was meant by things. So I think there was some sort of old timey jargon that was thrown in there, even if all of the language wasn't super old timey. But I really did enjoy the you know, resilient women in this story. It was nice to see three women who are very much in charge of their own destiny. And, you know, sometimes things happen that they couldn't control, but they made choices all along the way that sort of got them to the places where they ended up. And I appreciated that. And I especially appreciated when they finally sort of everything came together And you had those women sometimes working together, sometimes not working together, sometimes working at cross purposes. And that was very interesting, but it seemed like it took so long for anything to happen that this was not my favorite of all of the books, because it felt kind of slow and draggy. And as much as I enjoyed seeing these women, do the things that they were doing, I felt like none of these characters were pulling at my heartstrings in the way some of the characters in other books sometimes do. So it didn't end up, I didn't end up loving it, but I still solidly liked it. And I plan on, you know, picking up the next Naomi Novik book that comes around. I kind of hope it's a little more Uprooted and a little less Spinning Silver.
Yeah. I don't know what it is, 'cause I loved Uprooted so much. And I thought I liked it. I thought it was fine. Yeah. But it does, I think Aline said, it goes on too long. I think it absolutely goes on too long. There's a point, I don't know, 2/3 of the way through it, where it feels very much like it's wrapping up, and then she makes a narrative decision, and then it goes on for another, I don't know, 200 pages, 150 pages. Mm-hmm. Seemed like forever. And I felt like she just kind of, I don't know, maybe didn't want to stop. But it felt really weird, like the book just decided to swerve and keep going, and I was kind of ready for it to be at an end at that point. And the writing style, like, I don't entirely agree, because I read the first two chapters of this and I thought, oh my god, this is so well written, she's so good at this. I feel like I've read two amazing short stories, but they're interconnected and there's going to be more. But I have to say, the further the book goes, the less I felt that, and the more I don't want to diagnose a writer's book. She knows how the writing came about, but it feels kind of like it got away from her and that it went in places that she wasn't really anticipating. And maybe she didn't make, you know, cut some stuff out that she felt like she didn't need to, because she's a very successful writer at this point. But it felt to me like this book was too long and that there were things in it that should have come out. It's not that it's bad, because I did enjoy the whole thing, but it is strangely paced, and it feels like the last part of it is a lot less essential than the first part of it for some reason. I don't know. I had similar feelings.
And the very end felt a little abrupt to me, too, like on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, there comes a time where there's a resolution, but there's this piece sort of toward the end where it starts to get, I feel like, really muddled for a while. And there's some labored stuff, too, where there's like that cabin in the woods that's in the two universes at once. And I feel like the book goes a long time where it's like, but it's the same and they can't see each other. And I thought, yeah, I got that. Like, I got that hundreds of pages ago, but the book wants us to be more surprised by it, and I didn't find it remotely surprising. So I had a few moments of that, which is like, why are you talking more about the fact that they put a thing here and it disappears and it reappears over there? It's like, we got it already. I don't know. Scott, what did you think?
Well, I went to look up how long Uprooted was versus this book. And so this Spinning Silver is about 40 pages longer than Uprooted was.
That's all, huh?
Exactly. It felt to me like it was maybe 120 pages longer Uprooted. Yeah. And I don't know why. I will say that I still think Naomi Novik is a fantastic writer. And I enjoyed reading it. I think that I will echo what everyone else said. And I think she just had so many ideas. She wanted to stuff it in this book. And so she kept stuffing stuff in. And it's all interesting, but I don't know if it all needed to be in the book. I was frankly much more interested in the character when it was about how, you know, so one of the three women is Jewish. And so I found it very interesting, the whole family and how they're kind of ostracized because they are moneylenders and everybody hates them, but they need them because, and so she's turning silver into gold through that, like, you know, metaphorically. And then she actually has the power to literally turn silver into gold, which, you know, I saw coming, I suppose, because it's in the name of the book. But I thought it was more interesting when it wasn't all the magic. And I didn't really like the interludes in the mystical winter ice mountain that was melting, and then there's a crack and she's turning everything to gold. And I was like, I don't need to know about these silent people and they stand in icy forests. Like, I don't really care about them.
Yeah,
oh, I didn't like it.
the fact that Miriam is Jewish, I thought was interesting, and I like that because like you said, it Naomi Novik, who has a Jewish parent, I think leans into something. I told Lauren, who is Jewish, my wife, that this book leans into something that I think a lot of books might shy away from, which is Jewish characters and like they're the moneylenders in the town, which is such a stereotype and is used a lot in anti-Semitic kind of imagery, but is also has some basis in history. And she portrays that, you know, the whole picture here, which is they're relied upon and yet also treated with very little respect. And it becomes clear to Miriam at several points that basically she can't count on the people of her town because they don't consider her part of the town, even though she grew up there. And Naomi Novik engages with that whole aspect of that in a way that I thought was really good because, yeah, all the stuff in the town and the stuff with the brother and the sister and the abusive father and, like, there's so much of that that's really good. And I agree, a little of turning things into gold in a big room in a castle above a mountain made of ice goes a long way.
Yes. And I did like, I thought it was even so, you know, when we're in the village and she is, you know, dealing with her social status and how she's important, but nobody likes her family. But she has these memories of, you know, her grandfather is an important man. And so, you know, when she goes to visit him, you think, well, clearly he's important, so he'll be treated with respect. But no, he's important, but he's only allowed to have a fancy house in a certain area. And he only goes to visit the Duke, I think, is it, or King? I don't remember what royalty. Like no one can know that he's important and he's visiting the Duke because he's Jewish. And so he can't really, he's not allowed to be recognized, but the kingdom wouldn't run without him. So I just thought it was all very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I really liked the scenes where Miriam goes to visit her grandfather, because Miriam's father has not been very good at being a moneylender because he's too kind-hearted is kind of what it comes down to in her mind. And her grandfather is much more like she is, very practical and willing to just, you know, get the job done. And, you know, she's accidentally sort of made this pact with the Starek, the winter people, and, you know, comes clean to her grandfather in one scene, and he's again just super practical about it and is like, okay, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna make this happen, and you're gonna go here and you're gonna talk to this person and we're gonna make it work. And, you know, good on you for being my granddaughter and, you know, getting things done. I really liked, of all of the different characters in the book, I think the relationship between those two was the one that stuck out the most, because they were two people that really were on the same page and understood each other in a way that I don't think any other two characters in the book really did.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it's one of those things where I didn't like it as much as four of the other books that I read out of these six, but I didn't dislike it. I had more problems with it than I had the others, but I did enjoy reading it. And I think Naomi Novik is a really good writer. And I suppose that means that at some point I think I bought the first one of the Temeraire books. I will get there at some point because I loved Uprooted and I liked Spinning Silver. There's a lot of good stuff in there. There's something strange about it that, no, there's just, I don't know, something about
it's
it.
It's cold.
Too much gold in there.
It's cold.
A little too much book. It just dragged for me at the end. That's the funny thing, is that I was actually really into it and reading it fast. And then the last part of it, it turned into more effort. And I think that's a sign that
I liked the end better than I liked the beginning. I felt like it was dragging until maybe the part that you thought it picked up, or that it slowed down, is where I thought it picked up.
You just can't please anyone or everyone.
Nope.
Somebody
all the time.
That's why I don't do anything.
Yeah, that's good good choice. Let's move on to Trail of Lightning by Rebecca Roanhorse. This is a story about a young woman who has been trained as a monster hunter, a supernaturally gifted killer. This is in a post-apocalyptic world where the seas have risen and most of modern civilization, American civilization, has fallen apart. But on the Navajo reservation, they're doing fine. Although the gods and monsters of their religion and their legend are real there's like a coyote and
they're back.
They've come back as a part of the end of the white people's world. They have come back to the Navajo, and we have to learn about what life is like on the land. And what Maggie has been trained, she's got a kind of dark past that is only revealed sort of as we go and we learn about this world that she inhabits. But she's also has a job to do, which is often terrible. And when we meet her, she is trying to find somebody, a little girl who's been taken up into the mountains by a monster. And she discovers the monster, but she also discovers that the little girl has already been basically bitten by the vampire monster, whatever, and is going to become a monster. And so she has to kill the little girl because mm-hmm. the little girl is going to be a monster too. And that's how we meet Maggie. And basically that's the book saying, yeah, it's really messed up. This is why she is the way she is, because it's super messed up. And then from there, we find out that she's been trained by somebody who is of a questionable background. And there may be more to that story. And there's kind of like a couple of different plots that go back and forth where we're getting her history and we're learning about the land. And this is that is basically the Trail of Lightning, or as I like to think of it, Navajo Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
There's also a love story in this one as well, or a somewhat of sort a romance of. Kind of
flirtation.
You're right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Scott, what do you think of this one?
So I don't tend to like urban fantasy, and I guess this is more like a rural fantasy. I guess
urban fantasy
not in a city, but but it felt very urban fantasy to me, just minus the city. But I say that to set up the fact that I really like this book, because I enjoy it when I am reading a book from a perspective that is very different than my own, and I am not a Native American. So it was interesting to read about this, and kind of, the parallels. The author said she hadn't read many depictions of Native Americans in sci-fi fantasy, so she decided to write one herself, and I thought she did a good job. She also mentioned kind of this apocalypse that happens is not really the first apocalypse for the Native Americans. Like when America was colonized, that was kind of their apocalypse, and their world ended. Right. So this is really just like they were prepared for this. So it was not that big a leap for them. So and that just gives another whole level of interest for, I was going to say enjoyment, but that seems like something I shouldn't enjoy, but interest to the book. And I liked Maggie as a character. She's no nonsense. She has a job to do. She's got a complicated backstory. She has, limited friends. She doesn't trust people mm-hmm. for good reason. So I liked it a lot. Surprisingly, I did not expect to like this book, but I did.
Erica?
I also really like this book. When it comes to just like the ease of reading, I found this one just so easy to dive into. And when I would put it down, I would be thinking about, when can I pick it up again? When can I find out what happens next? I do like urban fantasy, but I don't really like the desert. Just sort of in general, that's not a backdrop in the real world or in books that I really love.
That's why I make you play Dark Sun.
Yeah, I don't know how you got me to do that. But yeah, so the setting was definitely not like a comfortable place for me, but I felt like maybe that was all to the good, because like Scott said, it's fun to read about and from perspectives that are different from my own. So I definitely felt like I was getting a very different perspective on the world, both from a setting standpoint as well as from a cultural standpoint. So it all sort of felt like it kind of blended together really well, and it was really interesting to see the depiction of the gods, and sort of how different that is from the way gods are often depicted in European old-fashioned fairy tale type fantasy, where sometimes it's similar and sometimes it's not so similar. And these gods felt very much more down to earth, I guess, would be at least certainly the coyote god that is meddling in and out of her life quite a bit from the beginning to the end mm-hmm. Of her life, if not just the book. And there's a lot of what is actually happening, and who, again, who can you trust? That was something that I was enjoying in Witchmark, as I mentioned before. I enjoyed that here too, that Maggie is not entirely sure who to trust. So she basically just doesn't trust anybody. She's that kind of character. And it was fun to read that, but at the same time, I found it a little bit, you know, this is another post-apocalyptic book, and that those kind of stories are starting to wear on me, because I just feel like apocalypses are not necessarily as far off as I used to think they were. So it's harder and harder to read those kinds of books. Mm-hmm. So that was maybe a mark against the book, but it's not really the fault of the book. That's more of the fault of the real world. And so, but I did really, really enjoy the book.
Aline, what about you?
I loved it. So I grew up in southwestern Colorado, near the Navajo Nation. And, you know, some of the first jobs I had, I worked with members of the Navajo tribe. I grew up hearing the language, you know, not that I understood or whatever, but I would hear people talking to each other. So this was very much like coming home in a lot of ways to me. So I grew up, you know, kind of the foothills of the Rockies, kind of, but also kind of the high desert. And I don't know, it was just, I don't want to claim representation in this that doesn't actually exist, but it was so close to my home and people I recognized and grew up with, and areas I know well. And it was just, it was so good from that standpoint. And then on top of that, hearing stories of Coyote, the trickster god, and all of this, like, Coyote's introduced and I'm like, yeah, you're up to no good. You know, just because I know these stories, I grew up with these stories, and it was so cool to have those in this book. And, you know, me getting that as a white woman, just being adjacent to the culture, I'm so glad that she wrote it for people who actually belong to this culture. And it's just, it's a good book. The story is good. The characters are good. It was so good. I don't know. I really loved it.
Yeah, I loved it too. I thought it was great. Buffy is my favorite TV show, and this is, it gave me those vibes. I really like, you know, it is a young woman who is kind of on her own, and it has a task to do that is unpleasant, but no one else is going to do it. And so she knows she has to have that responsibility, to do it. She gets in trouble. She makes mistakes. She's got this past that turns out is a bigger burden and problem than we realize at the beginning. Even the book sort of says so, but then you get late in the book and you're like, oh no, that's really bad. Like, it's well done. You've got, yes, feuding gods and people with power trying to fight it out amid this very strange kind of post-apocalyptic for the world outside, but kind of good for the world inside setting. Really unique setting. Yes, as Scott said, the flavor of characters and a world that we haven't seen before, because this is a Native American author talking about it's a world that I have not read a lot about. That part is fun too. So, I thought it was great. I thought it was I loved, to Erica's point, I kept thinking about it when I wasn't reading it and wanting to go back to it. And that's one of the greatest signs that you're really loving a book, is if you aren't making an effort to get through it. You are just flying through it. And that is absolutely how I felt about Trail of Lightning. It's great. Anything else? No.
Nope.
We did it. Okay. All right. Let's move on to The Poppy War by R.F. Kuang. This is a book. How do I describe this? The first part of it is, let me back up. It is another book where there are countries and stuff that are not in existence in our world. But it is very clearly paralleling China in the 20th century, and there's very clearly a kind of Japan analog, but it's not. There's magic, right? So it's not very similar to Witchmark. It is like our world, but not our world. And the first part of it feels very Harry Pottery to me, in the sense that it is about somebody who is from out in the middle of nowhere, who never gets into the big academy in this world where all of the great people are trained, who go into the military or the government or whatever. But this character qualifies and gets to go. What happens is that she's ostracized, but then she's sort of like mentored by somebody who turns out to be much more important than you think. And I thought, like, I know where this book is going. I see what is happening here. And it's fun. And the magic system and the powers and the different schools within the school, all very interesting. That's like the first third of the book, maybe the first half.
Let your kids read this book. It's a great
This is the thing. So that part of it really did remind me of like a coming of age story, right? With some difficult stuff, but it is a coming of age story. And then what happens is the war starts, and things get really bad really fast, and the characters have to go off and fight in the war. And there are like extended scenes where they're off in various places and have to use, you know, various magical powers that they've got to horribly kill people or be horribly killed by other people. And then, you know, and they end up with a kind of like going to the place where all the gods are trapped to let them out. But this is like what I'm saying is, it takes a turn and it gets kind of rough. I mean, in terms of tone and dark.
Kind of.
And I really liked the first part, and the rest of it I liked. I was more kind of surprised that it was all happening in the same book. And I kind of felt, by the time I got to the end of the Poppy War, I felt like I had read three different books. One of which I loved, and two of which continued the story with those characters, but were of a very different tone and were, unpleasant in terms of their content, but not poorly done by any stretch of the imagination. So very strange feelings for me about the Poppy War, because there were parts of it that I thought were fantastic, but as the story progressed, it was not at all what I thought that it was going to be. Aline, what'd you think of this one?
I'm sitting here nodding. So I've read this in December, and I've been trying all day to remember like how I felt about it as I was reading it or after I read it. I remember really, again, like you said, liking the first part and also liking, you know, the subsequent parts. I think I glommed on to kind of the more magical, mythological pieces than the military war pieces, because that's not really my bag. Is that I skip scenes if I can of military and strategy and that kind of stuff. And so there are some militaristic things in here that I didn't like so much. It's so well written, and the characters, I really, really like the characters, especially that teacher. I liked him a lot, but I don't know. I remember really liking it at the time, but now I'm sitting here thinking about it and going, but what was it I really liked about it? And what did I maybe not like so much? And I can't remember, and I'm a little bit worried that it's not memorable enough.
Hmm. Erica?
Oh boy.
Oh boy.
This is the only book that I had no trouble putting on my list of ranking, because it is so far below all of the other ones that it's easy. And I will agree that this book is very well written. I think that that Quang is a very good writer. This book was just super not for me. The beginning part, I usually like the kind of story where, you know, a kid is plopped into, you know, a kid from like kind of a poor background is plopped into a richy rich school and has to get by there. But I didn't like the character. She, from the beginning, seemed very angry and made a lot of choices that were foolish. And I mean, yes, that's how you sometimes get drama, but it just, it all kind of started to rub me the wrong way. And even while she's still at school, you know, she gets her teacher, who I did think was a really cool character. I liked him a lot. But she's sort of presented with this idea, and I kind of went, okay, at some point in this book, by the end, she's going to have to make a choice sort of between going in one direction, kind of a more pacifist direction, or the more sort of warlike direction. And I was like, oh, she's going to make the choice that I'm going to hate, isn't she? And she did, which is not that's not like a big spoiler, because the rest of the book is all about war.
But she carried a pig up a mountain. Well, that is a thing that happened anyway.
That was interesting. Like I would say that the first part of the book, the school part of the book, I thought was all right. Like that was fine. And then when it started to evolve and change, it turned into a war book, and I don't like war stories like really at all. Even when there's magic, and the magic was kind of interesting, but because I didn't really care about the main character or the other characters that she was, except for her good friend, and I can't remember his name, but like the one guy that she makes friends with in the school manages to pop up again and again a few times later in the book, and I kind of liked him. But when the only character that you really like is somebody who isn't there the whole time and is only a side character when he is, that's not a super great thing. And then there was one particular sequence where they enter the city that had been completely sacked by like the other side of the war, right. And there are bodies and body parts everywhere, and there's very, very specific and graphic descriptions of what was done to these people before they died, and what was done to the women who were kept alive in relaxation houses, women and children. I found it literally stomach turning. And like, I don't think I've ever really wanted to scrub a book out of my mind before, but if I could take some sort of memory altering drug, I would literally just choose to forget this entire book. Right.
But that is what the Japanese did in China. I mean, that's why it is being told that way. And so I went with it because I'm like, I see what you're doing here.
Oh yeah.
What I was going to say is that the before that, there's the extended scene where they're kind of like in that city, and then they go out to the marshes and all of that, and they're right on the coast there. And I thought that was an interesting kind of set piece. But the way I would describe it, since I said the first part's kind of like Harry Potter, I'd be like, imagine in the middle of the fifth year of Harry Potter, instead of having a fun tournament, they took all of them and put them in the middle of a war zone and gave them orders to kill a lot of people with their magic powers. Because that's basically what happens, is there's a group of these students and former students who have these various capabilities, and they are like really messed up. I mean, I was going to say, it reminded me like maybe of the X-Men or something, where it's like they're young people with powers who are being, but now they're being used in this case by a military force. And the ethics of it are, I was going to say questionable, but it's like, you don't need to question it. They're bad. Like, they're bad. It's not a good idea, and it doesn't go well for them. And I thought that was fascinating, but it also was, it was not fun at all.
Yeah. And I was mentally not prepared for that, especially after
because it gets darker and darker and darker, and they get to the place that where almost everybody's died, and then from there it's sort of like, now let's go to where all the gods are jailed up, where you can basically sacrifice your soul in order to or loose monsters on the world. Those are your choices. Is you can like, would you like to win this war? Well, one way to do it is to loose the most dangerous monsters ever seen by humanity on your opposition, and when they're done with them, they'll kill you too, but you could spite them all. And that's the decision that the characters sort of have to make at the end, which is it's pretty dark, pretty dark. Scott?
I agree with everyone that it was very well written, very dark, kind of abruptly dark. It's a surprise.
It does happen fast.
Yes. Don't let your kids read this book.
No.
or you should read it first and then you'll say, I shouldn't let my kids read this book. But that's your choice, not mine. You're responsible parents, I assume. But that being said, I enjoyed it. I thought it was well written, compelling, kind of once again, in a setting and a perspective that I don't know all that much about, but is an important period of history that should not be forgotten. So I think that it serves an important purpose culturally. And, you know, sometimes when you say that about books, it means it's not very good, but it's it serves a purpose. But I did think it was well written and enjoyable. For certain definitions of the word enjoyable, because it is difficult to read because of the horrific things that are happening, that are doubly horrific because you know they're based on real things that happened.
Right. Yep. Yep. No, I think I think we've described it in a way that explains why some of us liked it and some of us didn't like it. And as a listener, you probably now know whether this is a book,
if you're
going to
read it or not.
Yeah. If you decide you want to read it, it's good. It's just, you know.
Well, and be warned. Like, I think it's actually, I would have, expectations are a funny thing. People talk about, like, oh, I don't want to be spoiled and all that. Like, I think it's very useful to know going into the Poppy War that what it's not is a delightful coming of age story about people who have magic powers who are learning at a special school. Because while that happens, it also stops happening. And then it all gets a little too real after that. So
yeah, I can imagine someone like reading the first couple pages in a bookstore and thinking, oh, this is a cute young adult book that I should buy for, you know, my whatever.
Yeah.
That's not, you shouldn't buy this thinking it's a cute young adult book, because it is not young adult at all.
No. All right, that brings us to book number 5 of 6, which is Blackfish City by Sam J. Miller. This is a book that is set also post-climate change apocalypse on a floating city in the Arctic Circle. The oceans have risen. This is a floating city over a geothermal vent. It's got sustainable energy. There's a whole culture. There are sort of like the poor parts and the rich people parts, the rich people who own the land, and then the people who kind of are squatting. And there's a whole society that's built up here. A woman riding on the back of an orca with a polar bear as their companion arrives, and this surprises everybody. And they're... this is the talk of the floating city, but actually it also kicks off the plot, and there are other characters that we meet who are connected in unexpected ways to the woman on the orca. And along the way, we also learn about a strange disease that is infecting the population, that is spreading but is being suppressed sort of by the authorities, called the Breaks. And one of our main characters is coming down with it. Another character, another viewpoint character, is getting it or spreading it or both. And then it all kind of starts to come together where all these connections get made. And there are some surprising things that happen to the society and the central government of Blackfish City. So, Erica, what'd you think of this one?
I loved this book so much, and I'm not even entirely sure why, because I think there were a lot of bits and pieces of it that just didn't really appeal to me, but there was something about it that just sort of reached out and grabbed me. And this was another one where I did not want to put it down, and every time I put it down, I wanted to pick it back up. And when I finished reading it, I had about 3 days where in my head I'd be like, oh, I should pick that back. Oh no, it's over. Like, that doesn't happen with every book for me, and it really did with Blackfish City very strongly. And I think it was just because the world building was so good. Well, specifically the city building. I really felt like this was a city that I could picture in my head. And, you know, it's got these 8 arms that sort of stick out into the ocean, and it's heated by this, I don't know, a volcano or something
that? Yeah, it's like volcanic vents. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there's the richy sections and then the poor sections. And we've got all of these different point of view characters. And I can't actually say that I truly liked any of the point of view characters at all, but I was interested in what they were doing, and I was interested in how they interacted with the city around them and how their interactions with the city were very different from each other, depending on sort of what class in the city they came from. They had access to very different ways of transportation. The food that they ate was different. The people that they ran into, how much risk they took just from, you know, sort of being out on the street. There's one kid who sleeps in basically a box that's just barely big enough for him to lay down, and he has to rent it for the night. And then there's the guy who has access to however many apartments he wants because he's super, super rich.
Right.
And I found myself wanting to come back and figure out what's happening with the breaks, like this mysterious disease that has something to do with being infected with other people's memories somehow. But then it was interspersed with these City Without a Map, which is kind of like, it's like a podcast almost.
Yep.
That at first the characters, or some of the characters, think that it's kind of like an introductory course for people who are new to the city, and each episode is read by a different person, and sometimes they're in different languages. And I actually found those really kind of interminable, and I didn't enjoy them. They were pretty, they were very poetic, but I just kind of found myself skimming through them to get to the next thing that was happening in the book. And sort of as I was reading it, it sometimes I'd be like, oh, this is okay, this is fine, but then I would put it down and I would just want to pick it right back up again. So it had some addictive property to it, I guess, that really, really, really worked on me, because I thought it was great, even if I didn't really care all that much about the people. I wanted to know what they were doing and where they were doing it.
Scott?
So this book reminded me a lot of 2312 by Kim Stanley Robinson.
Yeah, me too, except I like this one.
I really liked 2312, and I really liked this book as well. I think they're covering a lot of the same themes. They're using a lot of the same literary devices. The language in this book, I think, is much more easy. It goes down easier, I think, than Kim Stanley Robinson's prose. And I like Kim Stanley Robinson. They're just very different writers, but they're dealing with similar themes. And I found I agree with everything Erica said. Basically, it was spoiler alert, my favorite of the nominees. I just thought it was. The things I like it when the books that are nominated for these prizes are unlike any other books I have read. And even though I found parallels with 2312, this book was completely different than 2312 and completely different than any other book I have read in a long time. And plus it has a polar bear that attacks me. So that's fun.
And there's a monkey later too.
Oh, yes.
Yes, there's a monkey.
And a bird of some sort, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Or is it the monkey what I'm thinking of? I don't know. I don't remember if there's a bird or a monkey.
Bird mentioned a few times.
Oh. Okay, there you go. But I liked it. All kinds of wacky stuff happens, and I enjoyed it.
Very, very true. Very true. Aline?
And plus there's this whole plot about the rich character's father or is rich, and he has a whole bunch of empty apartments, right? Which is something that happens now. They're rich people just buy lots of apartments everywhere and keep them empty. So
yeah,
real estate sucks even in the post-apocalypse.
Yeah, and it's true. It's funny you mentioned 2312 because there's like a couple of flashbacks we get that are people who were in New York while the flooding was happening, and I thought it's basically like some of these characters were in 2312.
And this then is what happened to
Blackfish City,
the sequel.
Yeah, yeah. Aline.
I thought this book was a slog. I appreciated the city building and the way that they talk about the geothermal energy and that kind of stuff. I thought was interesting. I wasn't interested in anything else. It had an orca and I didn't care. I didn't. The polar bear was kind of cool, but like, I don't know what it was. It's another one where I don't know what it was. I think part of it is because I live downtown in a city where I can go out and I can see people sleeping in cardboard boxes. I can also see the tall buildings where people own condos and they don't live there. And I think that's part of it, is like these elements of society that I think are so problematic now were such a big part of the book. And I go to books to escape the things that I can see when I walk out my door. And I mean, not universally, but kind of in my science fiction type stuff, I don't necessarily want that. And I think that was a lot of it. And then I didn't like the characters. I thought they were all kind of jerk faces, and I just wasn't interested. I wasn't interested in learning more about the stratification of the city. This is my bottom pick. So Scott and I are nemeses once again.
Oh, wow. Man.
I know.
My nemesis too, because Blackfish City is also my number one.
Oh, no. Wow. Oh, no.
Yeah, I have this hovering sort of tied for second, third.
Oh my gosh.
I liked it a lot. It reminded me, more than 2312, it reminded me of Annalee Newitz's Autonomous, which we read last year.
Oh, so you didn't like that either.
It's about kind of like experimenting on humans in a post-apocalyptic, you know, seas have risen, old nation states have fallen apart kind of order, but with less weird robot sex. So, got that going for it.
It does.
Also, the stuff with the brakes and some of the prose as well actually gave me, and Scott won't know what I'm talking about here, a William Gibson kind of feel. I actually kind of got like a William Gibson feel from a lot of this book, which for me is a really good thing. That is a high compliment.
I have read Neuromancer.
Okay. It gave me some of that feel, which I really liked. I liked the setting. I liked Autonomous. I liked 2312. And I like this book. I think it's really good. I like how the characters come together in ways that surprised me as we get the backstory on them. I didn't think they were jerk faces. So there's that.
There are some of them.
Some of them are jerk faces. It's true. And how they all interact, and that the fact that we end up, you know, on the top of a, like there's like a prison break from a a skyscraper and there's a monkey, and I'm like, it goes to places that you're like, what just, okay, I'm gonna go with it. A lot of surprising places. So yeah, I liked it a lot too. I think it's really unusual and strange, you know, and the setting is unlike anything you've seen before in a lot of ways, but yeah, it was good. I liked it too. Sorry, Aline.
That's okay.
You're gonna be a dissenter on this one. That's okay.
Your reasons for not liking it totally make sense
totally.
To me. Like, yes. I agree. Like I said, I didn't really care that much about the characters, so I'm on Team Jerkface. Like, I just liked everything else enough that it more than made up for that.
Mm. I liked the cover. I thought the cover was really cool.
It does have a good cover.
Mm-hmm. All right, and that leaves The Calculating Stars by Mary Robinette Kowal. This is an alt history story about the early days of the space race, because a meteorite blows up the East Coast at the very beginning of the story. The space race happens in a different way and with some different motivations, but in the end, it's kind of weaving the familiar story, which I love that kind of stuff, about the early days of the space race and, you know, figuring out how to send people to space and the test pilots who are going to pilot the ships. And then the main character is a woman who is very clearly going to be fated to be the first woman in space, but how she gets there is kind of an unusual path. Another Jewish main character, and there is some interesting stuff there about her relationship with some of the black characters, where she's got her privilege as a white person, but she's also got her problems because she's a Jewish person, and so it sort of depends on the interactions with other people about sort of like how she fits. And of course, being the woman who is innately qualified to do this, but because she's a woman, she's seen as a curiosity or simply not up for the job. So it is that story ultimately about Elma becoming the first woman astronaut and the unusual path she has to get there. But there's a lot of other kind of dramatic things. And there's speaking of jerk faces, there's a character who is very clearly fated to be the superstar astronaut of the country. And he's a jerk face. And that doesn't even begin to describe it. And yeah, it's the story of how after this horrible thing happens on the East Coast, humanity kind of gets together and figures out how to send people into space to possibly save humanity. And I'm going to say that I'll go first on this one and just say this was the easy one for me to rank because I liked this book far and away better than any other book I've read in the last year. The only book that comes close to it is its sequel, which was published 2 months after this book was published. I think this, The Calculating Stars, is exactly the kind of book that I enjoy, apparently. I loved it. I loved everything about it. So tops for me. People should go out and read it immediately. Pause this podcast and go read a book. Aline, what about you?
Same. I adored it. I read it. So I bought it in the bookstore the week it came out because I know people who know the author. And I was like, sure, I'll support a friend of a friend, basically, you know. And I'd never read any of her other books. I read the short story that was nominated for a Hugo a couple of years before and thought it was okay, but wasn't super in love with it. And got home, read this book, and I inhaled it. I loved it so much. And then I can't remember if I was like, you know, bouncing, waiting for the second one, or if I then went and used an Audible credit to get The Calculating Stars again and listened to it. But either way, I've read both The Calculating Stars and The Faded Sky, I think, twice and listened to them once, and I love them in both formats. I think they work so well, but I will say Kowal reads the books for the audiobooks, and she is amazing. She's also like a performer. She's a puppeteer.
And a professional like audio narrator. She does other books as well.
Yeah, she does. So, and she's amazing. And it gave more dimension to the characters. Very well fleshed out characters listening to her read them. It was just a really great experience. Anyway, I love them. Also my top pick, spoilers for the end of the show.
And people can listen to episode 427 of The Incomparable, where we talk about this book and its sequel as well. Scott's wife is on that episode, but not Scott. So Scott, what'd you think of this book?
There's a reason I wasn't on that episode. I had read the book and I knew that people really liked it. So I didn't want to be the person who thought it was fine and brought everybody down. So,
it now.
But I will, because I thought it was fine. I don't think it's my favorite book of hers, frankly. It just didn't hit me the way it hit other people. I didn't really care for the main character, so that's a problem with the book. And I didn't, you know, it just wasn't for me. So that's all I got.
All right.
Well written, but just not for me.
Erica?
Here, Scott. Here. I'll do the full disclosure. I do know Mary Robinette, like not super well, but we've hung out, and she is one of the nicest people, and honestly, one of the greatest writers that I know. She's so, so good, and I've read some of her other stuff, but this book was very much aimed at Jason.
Yay.
And not at me. I don't like alternate history so much, so it kind of had that against it. I really just don't care about space stuff, so that didn't feel great for me. And kind of the way, Aline, you were saying you had some trouble with Blackfish City because you kind of more wanted escapey stuff. That the stuff that I want escape from is the sexism and racism that I have to deal with in my everyday life, and this book did such a really, really good job of portraying what the sexism, you know, the casual sexism and blatant racism was of the time, that, you know, it's it was very well done, but it was too well done because I couldn't handle it. I found myself not wanting to pick this book up to read it again because I knew I was going back into that world and into that place that's so well described, that icky feeling that I get in my stomach when I have to deal with that sort of stuff. So I felt like Jason's right. It's a really good book. And if the things about it sound good to you, you should definitely go out and buy it and its sequel and get the audio versions and listen.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to, if the idea of an alt history version of the space race with fictionalized, you know, characters, but still it's that same kind of thing to get to a space and the moon. And then the second book is like to get people to Mars and an adventure along the way of like, how are we going to get people to Mars and what are there going to be accidents and how do we survive and all of those things. If that hits you as like, oh man, that is right up my alley, those are the books for you. If that stuff doesn't do it for you, well, that's what those books are, so don't go there. Yeah.
If you want something that she wrote that was like fantasy, there's a lovely, I don't know if it's a short story or a novelette, called Worshipful Society of Glovers, which is I think my favorite thing that she's ever written. So go read that if you're more Team Erica here.
Well, and what else is she? I mean, I like Ghost Talkers. That was really good.
And she wrote, I don't know what it's called, but there's a series. Yes, The Glamorous. There you go. Yeah. I've read all of those and they're very good. I enjoy them.
I've only read one of those, but it was also really good. She's really good.
She sneaks the Doctor into every one of those.
Yes. That's the series where there's a character who appears who's definitely one of the Doctor Who incarnations, and it's just thrown in there.
Who doesn't love that?
She's not.
But
the
I did.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, Scott, she's not the one who wrote the book about dragons, talking dragons with hats, is she?
No, that's no. Joe Walton.
Okay, whew, dodged a bullet there. No, Ghost Talkers, I think, is the one that I recently read that was really good.
I basically read The Calculating Stars, then read all of her other novels between reading The Calculating Stars and waiting and The Faded Sky, because I was just waiting. And so I read all of them in 2 months.
All right. Well, that is 6 books. And now has come the time when I am going to ask you to choose to rank these books from favorite to least favorite. Erica.
Boy, okay. So as I already mentioned, Blackfish City is number one. Not by a ton, though, because I felt like I loved it. I don't love it in the way that I've loved some of the books in previous years, but this is the one that came closest to that. And then the next three, you could almost just like roll the die and pitch, just
you
like
can
be
tie
like,
them
I
all
know.
If you want.
Yeah, I'm not going to do that, though. I will say that Witchmark is number two, Trail of Lightning is number three, and then Spinning Silver is number four. The Calculating Stars, despite being very good, just not for me, so that's number five. And then far down the list is The Poppy War, which was duper not for me.
And then at number 10, The Poppy War. okay, Aline?
So sometimes when I talk to y'all, and then we have to rank them.
It's amazing.
It's harder, but this time it's easy. You helped make it easier because I basically had my thirds. I had the two books I liked the most, which I knew about, and the two books I liked the least, which I already had, but I wasn't sure about the middle two. And talking with you helped crystallize what order this would go in. So my order is, number one is, of course, The Calculating Stars. Number two is Trail of Lightning. Number three is Spinning Silver. Number four is The Poppy War. Five is Witchmark. And six is the one I can't remember, Blackfish City. I liked it so well, I can't remember what it's called anymore.
All right. Ouch. The other one, whatever.
The other one, whatever.
You know, it happens. Scott,
process of elimination, that one.
It is, yes. I figured it out. I figured out what she was talking about. Scott, what about you?
So, interesting. I had my list, and this conversation has not changed at all. But it is exactly the same as Aline's, except you swap the last with the first. So, Blackfish
what?
Is the first. Wow. Calculating Stars is the last on my list, and the rest are the same. Trail of Lightning, Spinning Silver, Poppy War, and Witchmark.
Wild. Wow.
That's never happened, Scott. That's never ever happened.
You're like inverse nemesis with a twist.
That's right. We have more in common than we disagree.
But the disagreement is so strong.
So for me, it's The Calculating Star is number one, Trail of Lightning number two, Blackfish City number three, The Poppy War number four, Spinning Silver number five, and Witchmark number six. And that means that our consensus is Trail of Lightning at the top.
Interesting.
Followed by Blackfish City, sorry, Aline. Followed by The Calculating Stars, Aline, sorry, and I like it just too much, sorry. Then Spinning Silver, The Poppy War, and Witchmark. So, yeah, that's okay. But everybody gets to have their own ranking, and people out there could read all six books too. I think that some disagree, but I think they're all good. I did not, you know, some years, some short lists, and in fact, it might have happened with the Hugos this year. There's at least one book that I'm like, no. I didn't do that this time with the Nebula nominees. They're all good. I like some of them better than others, but I thought they were all good, and I read all of them and thought, yep, I can see why this was nominated, which sometimes, some years, that doesn't happen. I'm like, why?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know.
The thing I like about the Nebulas more than the Hugos is I feel like they're all, even if I don't like them, they're all well-written, usually. I would say 90% of the time.
Since the writers are the ones who are nominating them.
Exactly. So I appreciate the craft, if not the enjoyment of it. Whereas the Hugos, you get some and you think,
yeah,
no. What's wrong with you people?
I guess, yeah, there must be somebody. Yeah, the Hugos is the one where I start theorizing of like, this person must have a fan base or be popular in some other way, and it's given them visibility, or, you know, all those things, which may or may not be true, and awards are literally just a big popularity contest. But I think it's never a good sign when I start to just sort of muse to myself about what other reasons could have been involved for this book to be nominated, because it certainly wasn't merit, and that happens sometimes. So not this time. Not with these. These were all, I thought, solid. And that brings us to the end. So I guess it's just time to thank my guests for joining me and doing the homework, because this is a thing we do every year now, apparently, is we read the books on the shortlist. And there's that moment when the nominees come out and you're like, well, here goes my next 6 months. Gonna be reading nominees. That's just how it is. So Aline Sims, thanks for reading all the nominees.
Thanks for having me.
Erica Ensign, thanks for reading six. You know, 5 out of 6 liked is still a pretty good batting average.
Yeah. And I think this is the first time that I've actually been on a Nebula episode. Ooh. Because I managed to get the homework done. So yay me.
Yeah. And it's not just because you've won Hugo Awards and so the Nebulas can, you know, pound sand. That's not a reason.
I would never use that as a reason.
No, of course not. There's no sand in Canada. Scott McNulty, thank you.
Thank you, Jason, for forcing us to rank these books.
Yes, you're welcome. You were going to read them anyway, but now you've also ranked them.
That's right.
I find it most valuable to rank them long after you've forgotten them.
It makes it much easier.
It makes for the best sort of ranking system.
I agree.
And thanks to everybody out there. We hope we've maybe given you some ideas about books for you to read next. You don't have to read all six like we did. We're dumb. But you could read ones that strike your fancy. And we'll be back next week with more of The Incomparable, and in a month or two when we talk about the Hugo nominees too. But until then, goodbye.
Do-do-do-do-do. Lots of overlap there, too.
There is a lot of overlap there. That's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine. Maybe I'll read some of the short stories. I don't know.
Overall.
Oh.
I'm going to turn off the bootleg and the live stream now.
Bye, live stream.
Thanks to the one person, whoever you were.